respond to the presentation that will be made by the Law Society of South Africa. The meeting that we are in today is a meeting in which we are deliberating on the Road Accident Fund Transitional Provision Bill. And we are having public hearings from organizations that have indicated that they would want to make submissions in the process of deliberating on this bill. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the Law Society of South Africa and give you the opportunity to make your presentation. In this meeting, we have on my right-hand side members of the Portfolio Committee, starting from there. So here we are only short of one member who is going to join us. And then on the from the active parties in the committee. And then next to me are the representatives of the department and the Road Accident Fund, and then the Law Society. We have, because it's an open meeting, we have people from the media, as well as those who have a keen interest in what we are doing here. It is now over to the Law Society of South Africa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, you have our representations, our comments, with RA 12. You unfortunately don't have any comments on our comments from the Department of Transport that I submitted in the presentation. Our submissions, Madam Chair, are very simple, and they're following what we find in the Bruno case. And that case emphasized with respect that the Road Accident Fund Act.
Sorry, may I give guidance to the members? The submission that we are dealing with is number 12.
Yes. That the primary object of the Act is, as stated in the judgment of that chapter, to give the greatest possible protection to persons who have suffered loss through a negligent unlawful act on the part of the driver or under the motor vehicle. And he states in his judgment with respect to the
sorry, is it on? I thought it was on. On. Yeah. I don't see a reliance. Yeah.
And he states that by placing a cap on certain claims undermines this premise. Now, in the finding of the Mavuma case, the court was and found that the particular section was unconstitutional because it indirectly discriminated against a class of persons. And it found that the class of persons discriminated against were in general the poor and the black poor, because those are the people who are passengers in taxi and buses. Now, we have that situation now. You as a committee are charged with a duty to try and come to a solution. And we are trying to assist you, our argument being that we must give, as the court determined, the greatest protection to the most number of people we can. Now accepting that we have that the people who are discriminated against by the section are the poor, is we must try and ensure that they get some sort of compensation out of this new act, or the Transitional Act. We believe that to achieve this, that in weighing up what is required for the public and also what the fiscus can afford, is you can do this by limiting, by capping the loss of income, in that every person who is injured in an accident will still get some compensation for loss of income, but to the cap, which is 9 pounds. And also that by, but however, allowing an unlimited claim for general damages. We must remember that when considering the discrimination, we have to look at what is the situation pre-1 August 2008. We have to compare the passengers in the taxi before 1 August 2008 and compare the passengers or pedestrians not in the taxi, not claiming. They must, the Constitutional Court said, they must be treated equally as far as possible. And we believe that by giving up on the one hand and taking on the other, we can reach a situation which is satisfactory to all parties. So we believe that the general damages should not be capped. And we say in this regard that in the matter where the constitutionality of the amendments was determined of the new amendments was determined in the court in the Gauteng High Court with the Fabricius case judgment, he stated the following with regard to claims. And I just want to read the record because we submit that this is something which should be relevant and should be taken into consideration. I have mentioned that the vast majority of personal injury claims paid by the REF are far less than 50,000. I.e., of those claims finalized by the REF in 2009, excluding supplier claims, 92% were below 50,000. This occurred in 2008 as well. And the second respondent's reasoning then was that most of his claims of less than 50,000 relate to matters where less severe injuries have been sustained. It is not unusual in these claims for only general damages to be claimed. Now, if you're looking at 92% of the claims are less than 50,000, ergo it means that only 8% are more than 50,000. But that doesn't mean that those 8% don't have claims. But what we're saying is that particularly if you're dealing with the poor in the taxis and the buses, their claims are, in general, not exceedingly high. So allow them an unlimited general claim. Some people get 75, some people get 100, but it's not an exceedingly large amount of money, because it's not a, they're not high claims. 92% in 2008, actually slightly higher now with inflation, were less than 50,000. So we're saying you're not opening a complete can of worms by allowing them. And what you are doing, you are allowing the poor people to get some compensation for the injuries they've sustained. A lot of them won't have claims for lost earnings because they won't be working. A lot of them will not have the serious injuries as determined by the Amendment Act. And I raised just in debate here that under the new Act amendment, a loss of a lower limb below the knee amputation is not a serious injury as determined for general damages. Now that can naturally have devastating effects on people. We need a 30% whole person impairment, and a loss of a lower limb below the knee does not give you 30% impairment. So our argument is give the people who have suffered, give them an opportunity to be compensated for what they have lost. And we believe that by allowing that, one is getting closer to what the court determined in the Mabumba case, which was, remember, the claimants ideally should be treated equally. Ideally, a claimant, a passenger in a bus or a taxi who's injured pre-2008 should have an unlimited claim totally. That's what the court determined. He said, the court said, but however, this must go back to Parliament because there are financial constraints there. We say, constrain, limit the loss of earnings, which is still reasonably substantial, but so that people deserving will get a loss, but allow those who have no loss earnings or have general damages to be compensated. And thereby you'll extend the protection to at least 92% of the population in the minibus system.
We then, dealing with our submissions, raise the aspect that, and I'm turning to page 2 of our submissions, there I deal with at the bottom of the foot of the page, is the submissions we make on the proposal of the bill is that a person has to determine within a year, make a decision on whether they want to be their claim submitted under the old Act, that's the pre 2008 Act, or the transitional bill. We say if you have the distinction as the bill proposes on general damages, it raises a certain practical problem. And I think it's best to explain this by way of example. In the current situation, you have where, let's call it, two taxis collide. Currently, under the old Act, the passenger in the one taxi, if it's his driver or her driver, is solely to blame. They have a limited claim of 25,000 rand. And if the driver of the other vehicle is to blame, they have an unlimited claim. So one can be 25,000 rand, one can be 1 million rand, 2 million. Now, many of those cases are pending before the court. Now, if we state that the claimant must make a call, you're then expecting a claimant to make a consideration to come to make a decision on limited knowledge he has. Must I go for what I believe I'm entitled to, or must I take a limited claim? We say with particular regard to general damages, that's unfair. Why must he make this decision? Why can't the claimant or she have their full claim? A further practical aspect that resolves that, once the claim is submitted, and we now just after the courts the two cases, and the claimant decides to go the new Act, but wants to submit a claim for serious injury for general damages, an assessment now has to be submitted. So the whole case now goes back in limbo, because it's got to be stopped, because the Act requires, the new Act requires an assessment. So then you've got to go the assessment route, and then there are the new Act and the regulations have determinations. Who does determine whether it is a serious injury, so it can be a general damage? It's got to go back to the tribunal. So now it was suggested a court, matter about to go to court, has got to go backwards in the queue. We say if you do away with the cap on general damages, that won't happen. The claimant also won't have to make a call. He will be able to get his general damage. And it's not fair on a claimant to have to determine A or B, where that is really a decision for the court. So we say that is also unfair on the claim. Those are really, in essence, our submissions. Yes. And while we're discussing the new regulations, and I came across, it'll be RAF 4 of the bundle, that's 14, is a letter from a Mr. Govendine to the portfolio committee, and he raises a very practical problem. He says he presented himself to prove a claim for general damages or a serious injury, and he was told he had to have a doctor's assessment, and he was given a list of doctors which charged him between 3,000 and 7,000 rand for his assessment. Now, that is the practical problem claimants are finding themselves with. They now, before they can submit a serious injury claim, they have to have an assessment, a
And in general, although there are provisions in the regulation, but that those are not property in operation, they've got to pay for that assessment themselves. And that then is a limit to what they can do. He says here, and I don't know, Mr. Govender, I just read it from the series, is that there's a problem that when I submit myself to prove zero damages, we say if you compare pre-1 August 2008, the two claimants, the one in the taxi, the one not in the taxi, by applying particularly with regard to general damages, your proposal in terms of the transitional law, you are still discriminating against those passengers. And we say that by allowing an unlimited claim, you will limit that discrimination, and we believe you will then give the most cover to the people who require cover and compensation. Oh yes, and then just dealing on our submissions page 3, I didn't comment on the bill and proposal. I've dealt with what we say regarding paragraph section 218B, and in 21F we say it's unclear, and probably the draftsman would like to just clear that up. The proposal, the transitional bill, states in paragraph 21F, section 21F, the transitional regime does not affect the claims of the suppliers contemplated in terms of section 17.5 of the old Act in respect of costs incurred by the third party prior to this Act taking effect. We just raised the query whether it is doesn't limit the tariff or whether it still limits the amount to $25,000. We say that's not clear. As to that wording of that section is not clear. We say, unfortunately, that we believe the one-year period for the claimant to make up their mind is very short, but that's a practical solution. There's got to be finality to it, and the situation will naturally be that the miners who are injured in the before August 2008, they still got 15 years plus to claim before their claims are prescribed. But that's what we stuck with. Those are some reasons.
We will give members an opportunity to ask questions of clarity on the submission before we go to the council to give us a legal opinion or report to the submission by the Law Society of South Africa. Honourable Officer.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thank you for coming to present your case to us. I insisted last week that we actually pay some attention to your submission because I think it's substantive. We had a lot of submissions which were just complaints about service delivery, but we had three submissions which were quite substantive, and I think yours is the most important one. I need to ask you a question. You make quite a lot of comment about the caps and where they should be and so on. You obviously understand the fact that the fund doesn't currently have any money available to fund the additional payments that would come about as a result of this amendment to claimants. There is no money. The estimate based on the current proposal is that it's going to cost us $1.3 billion to fund these payments, these additional payments. So $1.3 billion is quite a substantial amount of money, and the fund admitted to us last week or the week before that they do not have the money. So it's going to be funded out of a debt. As I understand the Constitutional Court judgment, they were saying that we do not have to put the claimants who claimed before 2008 in the identical position that claimants after 2008 would find themselves in. However, the position that they were in before 2008 is patently unfair because their total claim is capped at 25,000. For us as Parliament, it's our role to try and find a middle ground somewhere where these claimants can get a reasonable payment for their injuries, their loss of income, and the other problems which they incur as a result of these accidents. But the court didn't define for Parliament what reasonable is. We have to try to establish as a Parliament what reasonable is. Now, the proposal by the Department says that we should cap the non-pecuniary loss, the general damages, as you call it. But my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that your loss of income is not capped under this current system. But what you seem to be arguing today is that we should rather cap the loss of income and not cap the general damages or non-pecuniary loss. Because your argument, I think, if I understand it correctly, is because most of these people, or a large number of the people who were in this position, were unemployed or nominally employed, their loss of income claims are going to be very negligible anyway, so there's no point trying to give unlimited loss of income because the amounts are going to be so small. But the non-pecuniary loss, your example of the missing leg, which you would say because of there's not a 30% impairment, is therefore not classified as serious, and therefore they can't claim for more than 25,000 for a loss which might be related to future potential income earning because they're now disabled. So your basic argument, if I understand it correctly, is don't cap the loss of income. Sorry, do cap the loss of income. Don't cap the general damages so that a person who is disabled would be able to claim more if they are disabled in the accident. Do I understand that aspect of your argument clearly? Because that, for me, is the substantive issue. A lot of the other things are technicalities relating to the wording which needs to be tidied up, which we can obviously do, and so on. But it seems to me that the big issue here is where we put a cap, because the fund doesn't have unlimited funds. We have an instruction by the Constitutional Court to try to make their position fair in terms of the rest of the claimants, but it doesn't have to be in the letter of the law identical, because there are constraints in the issue. So is that your basic problem, is that you're going to cap their non-pecuniary loss or their general damages, but you're not going to cap their loss of income, and it should be the other way around because of the class of person that is going to have to claim? Because that would be an important thing for us to understand as a committee.
You are partly correct there. Our submission is to try and give the most cover to the most people. And we believe that having regard to what the Constitutional Court find regarding who are the claimants who are being affected or discriminated by, that the majority of the people were people with general damages claims. And a general damages claim, as I understand it, for a poor, as the court found, is a poor claimant, it can make a substantial difference to their lives. We say it's very difficult to determine what is a serious injury, so to get serious general damages, to get general damages. And we say make that at the bottom, where the claims are, as we know, appear to be limited in extent, but more than the 25 proposed, because 92% of them are below the 50,000 mark. That's 2 years ago, so that should be higher. We say give them cover. Let them be compensated for the injury sustained by them. By the very nature of the finding in the Constitutional Court, it's referred
language of the people being the poor people. So if you cap their loss of income, there will be very few people who will be affected by the cap. But your outriders will be excluded. You're very wealthy, they will be excluded by the cap. But just to get back to the money that's available, we naturally don't know what the Rolex Fund really has, but one must remember that the Rolex Fund, I have here a strategic and annual performance plan, which was presented by the Rolex Fund on the 17th of March this year by Leslie Barn and Fossey, and they have a forecast of a financial turnover, and they forecast for the year 2012 that there will be a surplus. Well, I can only have what I have in front of me, and I can't take it further than this. It's a document, and the surplus getting bigger and bigger as the years progress of what they pay out. And we deal with, remember, it's very attractive to say it's financially it's insolvent by 42 billion. It's what comes in and what goes out. As long as you can keep rolling it, then it works. Okay, and that's what it's doing. And the anticipated, this document says, I don't know, you probably know better than I do, it says that there will be a surplus for a trading surplus of 1.8 billion. Now, I can't take that any further. I'm sure my little friends from the Rolex and Fund will take it further, but that's what it appears. And one must certainly cite that these claims that are coming through, the 1.3 million claims, are not all going to happen this year. They're not all going to happen next year or year after. They're going to be spread out over the years. So it's not a 1.3 billion rand immediately. It's a 200 million, 300 this year, and that's how it's going to go. So it's not, it's a problem, but it's not one that cannot be dealt with and solved. I don't know if that's answered your question. Well, you must understand, we can't answer that question. We can just put submissions, which we believe that one must have regard to, that it's a rolling system. As long as your income coming in can pay your debts that are required, then the system is, in inverted commas, working.
Are there any other questions of clarity? If there are none, can we then give the...
I'm not sure whether this is a question of clarity or not. I think it could be. Has the Law Society of South Africa done a financial impact assessment on the fund as a result of the amendment they're proposing? In other words, can they tell us this will be the extra or the diminished amount that will become liable in any particular financial year to be paid out as a result of this amendment? I'd just be interested to know that has been done.
Chair, we have not done an impact society, but we can't give an answer. But similarly, the estimated 1.3 is merely an estimate. It might be a lot less. No one knows on what that estimate is based on, because there are no proper records or anything like that. So as we can't give you a financial viability study, neither can the Rolex Fund.
Then have a response from the senior counsel. If we can have then Sir Michael.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Budlender, and I appear here on behalf of the Department of Transport. Can I at the outset apologize most sincerely for the delay that I caused this morning? It was entirely inadvertent, and I'm terribly sorry to have inconvenienced you and the members of your committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Madam Chair, it seems to us that the submission of the Law Society, though well-intentioned, and we accept, of course, that it's well-intentioned, suffers from some fatal misapprehensions. And one of those has already been pointed out by the Honourable Member who asked the first question. And I'd like to begin there, and then I will go into some of the detail. And the one that I would like to focus on is what the Constitutional Court said, as already has been made clear, in the Mbungu case. It did not say that the level of compensation given to the Mbungu-type claimants, these transitional claimants, had to be the same as as non-passengers under the old Act. If that had been the case, the Constitutional Court wouldn't have sent it back to Parliament to determine. They would have just made an order saying, well, whatever you had as a non-passenger claimant, an uncapped claimant under prior to 1 August 2008, now an Mbumbu-type claimant will get. They wouldn't have sent it back and taken up the time of this committee to do so. But instead, they said the opposite. They said, and I'm reading from the judgment in paragraph 53, the considerations mentioned above point to the fact that Parliament is best suited to determine the extent of the compensation to which the applicants are entitled. So they sent it back to this body to determine how much compensation they could be given. They certainly made clear that you couldn't leave it the way it was. You couldn't say 25,000 with people receiving nothing in practice. That was clear. But they said that because of the financial consequences and because of the fact that this is just a transitional measure, they would send it back to Parliament, and that's what they've done. And that's an important starting point in relation to this debate. The second point that needs to be understood, Madam Chair, is that this present bill, the scheme proposed by the present bill, is substantially more generous than two things. It's much, much, much more generous than the position under the old Act in respect of these type of claimants, and I'm going to give you a practical example in a moment. But it's also more generous even than the situation under the new Act, which applies to everyone. This Parliament, of course, adopted the new Act, the Road Accident Fund Amendment Act 19 of 2005, and said in that Act that there were various caps of various sorts, and of course the Constitutional Court upheld Parliament's decision to do so in the Law Society challenge. But this Act, quite rightly, is even more generous than that. And I think if I could just explain that, it might be helpful, because there also was, I think, a slight misapprehension on behalf of the Honourable Member about the cap on loss of earnings. So if I could just go through that for a moment. So the point of this Act is that what it does compared to the old Act is the following. Under the old Act, passengers subject to the caps could never receive more than 25,000 in total. Medical expenses, loss of income, general damages, everything added together could never amount to more than 25,000. Now under this Act, all of those passengers can claim for loss of earnings up to the limits in the new Act. That was the point I just wanted to clarify. It's up to the limits in the new Act, the 160, which is now increased with inflation to about 180 odd, I think. So all of them can claim loss of income up to the limits in the new Act. All of them can claim unlimited income and medical expenses, subject only to the tariff for emergency treatment. And all of them can claim up to 25,000 in general damages alone. So even if they got hundreds of thousands of rand or whatever the appropriate amount in loss of income, they can still claim up to 25,000 in general damages alone. And if they're seriously injured, they can claim unlimited general damages. Can I just demonstrate that by means of an example? If we take Mrs. Mbumbu, which is of course why we're here, Mrs. Mbumbu was the applicant and that's why we're here. Under the old Act, Mrs. Mbumbu was Mrs. Mbumbu had worked as a fruit picker in Stellenbosch. She was in the accident. She had a very significant injury to her foot, which means, according to her, that she's unable to walk properly, she's unable to stand. And under the old Act, what she got was effectively nothing, because she was entitled to 25,000, but the 25,000 got eaten up by her medical expenses at the hospital, and the hospital claimed first. So the money in Mrs. Mbumbu's pocket under the old Act was zero, absolutely zero. And that's the problem with the old Act. Under the new Act, Mrs. Mbumbu would be able to claim for her medical expenses at any reasonable cost, because there's no tariff for non-emergency. She would be able to claim for her loss of income up to the maximum of 180,000 a year. Now, we all know that someone who's working as a fruit picker is not earning 180,000 a year, so she'd be able to claim her full loss of income. And she would be able to claim up to 25,000 in general damages, even if she was not seriously injured. So at worst for her, she can claim her medical expenses, her loss of income in full, and up to 25,000 in general damages. If she can show that she's seriously injured, and I'll come back to that in a minute, if she can show that she's seriously injured, she'll be able to claim unlimited general damages, her general damages in full. So what's clear is that the bill is vastly, vastly more generous than the old Act, as it should be. The bill is also more generous than the new Act, because under the new Act, she could claim her medical expenses, she could could claim her loss of income, but she could only claim general damages if she was deemed to have a serious injury. If she didn't have a serious injury, she would get no general damages. Remember, under the bill, even if she doesn't have a serious injury, she gets $25,000. So I think it's just important when the representative of the Law Society says what we need is some compensation for these people. There is some compensation. There's this compensation. Each of them is getting the compensation which I've just outlined. Each of them is getting up to $25,000 in general damages, even if it's not a serious injury. So I think that's the important point that needs to be understood. This body is not required to give identical treatment as compared to uncapped claims prior to 1 August 2008. The Concord Constitutional Court doesn't require that. And the proposal put in place here is very substantial. And that's why it costs 1.3 billion rand. Can I just say on the 1.3 billion before I forget, the 1.3 billion is not a thumbsuck figure. It is the figure that is calculated by the RAF's actuaries based on the information available to the RAF. So that figure, it's not some estimate. It's an actuarial calculation. So that's the first point that I wanted to make. The second point, Madam Chair, that needed to be made is that what's really happening here is that the Law Society is trying to persuade this body to reconsider the decisions that it has made, that the Cabinet has made, and that the Court has endorsed, that you are not required to give general damages unlimited for all kinds of injuries. Parliament, when it enacted the 2005 Amendment Act, had a lengthy debate about whether there had to be unlimited general damages, or general damages at all, for non-serious injury claims for persons. And this body said, no, we are going to limit general damages only to the seriously injured. That was then challenged by the Law Society in the North Gauteng High Court, in the very judgment by Mr. Justice Fabricius that the Law Society referred to. And the court rejected that challenge. It said, and if I can just read that, neither was there any coherent argument presented in court in this particular context by the Law Society, and it is difficult, therefore, to discern on what possible basis the proviso should be declared unconstitutional. Persons with non-serious injuries can still claim general damages for pain. Persons with non-serious injuries cannot claim general damages for pain and suffering and loss of amenities of life, for instance, but they can still claim medical expenses and loss of earnings. So the North Gauteng High Court endorsed Parliament's choice as being constitutional that there wasn't a requirement that there be generals for non-seriously injured. And then when the Law Society went to the Constitutional Court in that matter, they didn't appeal that finding, so they accepted that it was correct. Subsequent to all of that, we of course all know that Cabinet has considered the issue again in the context of the RABs, and Cabinet has adopted the same approach, which is to say general damages should not be awarded for non-seriously injured persons. And so with respect, it can't be that under the guise of this transitional bill, which is just a bill designed to fix a problem between the two acts, that we're now reopening that whole debate. And that's why what the current bill proposes is it says, if you're seriously injured, you get full general damages. But if you're not seriously injured, we're going to put you in a good position relative to how you would have been under the old or new acts. We'll give you 25,000, but it's not unlimited. So that's the theory of it. Before I deal with the drafting points, can I just run through a couple of brief points that I just need to clarify in response to the submission of the Law Society. The first one is, the Law Society is correct that in order to be classified as seriously injured, you've got to satisfy the tests in the regulations. But it's not only 30% whole person impairment. What you will know, Madam Chair, is that those regulations say you can qualify in one of two ways. Firstly, you can say 30% whole person impairment, which is the score by the doctor, or if there is one of four options, for example, the serious or the permanent or long-term impairment of a bodily function. So it may well be that the person who loses a leg below the knee doesn't classify as 30% whole person impairment, but does classify under the narrative test. And that narrative test is the safeguard to ensure that people who do have serious injuries are caught. So the problem about the person under the leg, with great respect, isn't really properly put, because it's not only a 30% limit. If you qualify under the narrative, that's good enough. Then on the practical difficulties, the suggestion is made that the choice that people have to make between the old and the new act, that this bill requires a choice and that choice is impractical and unfair. Can I say two things on that? The first is, all of the people who are subject to this bill, by definition, have already submitted claims because remember they had to have been injured prior to 1 August 2008. So any claim is long since prescribed if they haven't submitted it. So the vast majority of them are represented by attorneys from the Law Society. So it's not the case of some person sitting in the middle of nowhere trying to make a decision on which act to adopt. It's the Law Society and its members who will be able to explain which act they should adopt. So there's no problem with that. Secondly, even if you adopted the Law Society's formulation for general damages, even if you said unlimited general damages, that wouldn't change the need to make an election. Because the election has to happen because, for example, if I was injured in a road accident, and I was subject to these requirements, I would have to decide, even on the Law Society's approach, would I rather go for limited but substantial compensation under the new bill, but no claim against the private wrongdoer? Or would I rather go for limited compensation to 25 under the old Act and an unlimited claim against the private wrongdoer? So in every case, whatever solution this Parliament comes up with, there's going to have to be an election. Because you can't take away people's rights, and some of them, a few of them, might be better off under the old Act. We think it's very, very few. And that's why we say everyone should be under the new Act unless they decide to go back to the old Act. But you can't say that there's not going to be a decision. There has to be a way of determining whether people are under the new Act or the old Act. But if no one makes a decision, if someone doesn't make a decision, if I'm the claimant and I don't make a decision, I'll be under the new Act. And it's 99% sure that I'll be much better off under the new Act than under the old Act. So the practical difficulties that are spoken about in relation to the election are not really with substance. And then the final point is, if I can just clarify the surplus issue. What seems to be confused here is the question of a surplus on an annual basis versus the accumulated deficit. The accumulated deficit is indeed 42 billion. And with respect, what's been made clear by Parliament, what's been made clear by the courts, and what's been made clear by the RAF is that a 42 billion deficit is absolutely unsustainable. And so to say, well, there might be a surplus in a given financial year and therefore we can use that, that doesn't begin to address it. The whole point is to try and unwind that 42 billion. And the court was well aware of the fact that the RAF was busy recovering money, but they were very anxious about the long-term 42 billion deficit. And so the fact that there might, I don't know the figures he speaks of, but what I can tell you is if those figures demonstrate a surplus, they demonstrate a surplus only over a given year. The overall position of the RAF is substantial deficit, approximately 40 or 42 billion rand. I think that deals with the, and then the very last point on the principal issue. The point is repeatedly made about the 92% who claim less than 50,000. Well, if 92% claim less than 50,000, many of those are going to be able to be accommodated by this bill because they will have a right to claim medicals, generals up to 25, and loss of income. In many cases, if you add those all together, they'll get to about 50,000. So the 92% are all being given something to claim. It's not as though they're being deprived. Madam Chair, then can I briefly deal with the specific comments on the clauses which were raised? The point about clauses 2.1 A and B and the problem of delay, we've made the point to the committee that there's no need for the delay in processing of these claims to be significant because the fund has already committed to prioritizing these claims. And the fund has, in fact, asked the Constitutional Court. You'll know that we need an order from the Constitutional Court to extend the period of suspension. The fund has asked the Constitutional Court to order that these claims be dealt with expeditiously. The fund and the minister, in fact, have asked the Constitutional Court. So there's no real cause for concern about delay. Then on the question of clause 2.1F, that's the one issue in which the department does agree with the LSSA that there is some uncertainty. You'll recall that 2.1F deals with the claims of suppliers for goods and services. And we agree with the LSSA that there's some ambiguity about whether it's intended. Let me say this. What was intended was simply to say, if you were a doctor or a hospital and you supplied people with medical treatment before this Act comes into force, you can still claim your full amount. You're not limited to the tariff because we don't want that to be unfair to people. But it wasn't an attempt to limit people to 25,000. And we've proposed a reformulation, and perhaps I could just read it out. It is in the written submission. If I could read it out. It says, notwithstanding the transitional regime, Section 17(4)B of the new Act and the tariffs thereunder shall have no effect on the claims of suppliers of goods or services in terms of Section 17.5 of the old Act in respect of costs incurred by the transitional third party prior to this section taking effect. That's a very long sentence. I appreciate that. We've tried to reformulate it about three times, and every time we leave something out. So we think it's a long sentence that probably needs to be there, because there are a range of concepts that need to be dealt with. And so that addresses the Law Society's concern fully. It says that provision only caps, that provision only says you're not limited to the tariffs. It doesn't reinstate the 25,000 rand cap. And then finally, in relation to clause 2.1g, there is a concern about the one-year period and the fact that the one-year period is extended for minors. The reason that we extended the one-year period for minors is because they are minors. You can't say that minors have to make the election within a year because they may not know their rights, they may need further time, and so that's why the Act says it's 1 year, but if you're under a disability, you're a minor, or you're suffering from a mental defect, then you have additional time to make your decision about which Act applies, and that's the reason. And so it's really a pro-claimant position, and that's the reason that approach is adopted. Madam Chair, I think those are the only points that I needed to make. Could I just check with my client to check that there's nothing else?
Thanks, Jefferson. We are happy with the reply and we leave it there for a lot of questions.
Thank you very much for the response by the Senior Counsel representing the Department of Transport. We will now give an opportunity to members to ask questions and make comments. Honorable
Chairperson, thank you. I've actually been very happy by sitting here listening to both submissions. I think we've had actually presentations that are quite outstanding. We've had high-level debate of these issues, and that raises the tone of what we sometimes have to deal with in this committee. So thank you very much to both of you. I think you've seriously made me sit and listen very carefully, which doesn't happen a lot in this committee. I have a particular question, though, and I don't mind whether the department answers it or the RAF or yourself as the advocate, I assume, or attorney. And that is the very important question raised by the Law Society around the cost of a medical exam, because we are dealing with poor people. And I actually accept a lot of what you're saying. In fact, I think you've paid very careful attention to the detail, and I like a lot of your responses because they do address some of the issues. But the one issue that's not addressed is the cost of a medical exam, because if I have to go and pay for an expensive medical exam which involves MRI scans and blah, 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 and I'm poor, and I'm unemployed, and I don't have the funds, and one of the problems the fund expenses right now is that too much of the money paid out gets gobbled up in legal expenses already. And I'm concerned about Mr. and Mrs. Unemployed who are in their taxi, who now have to go somewhere and get an expensive medical exam before they can institute their claim or subsequent to instituting their claim. And I'm quite concerned that the fund generally has to pay so much out to legal experts already that reduces the amount that the claimant receives. And if we reduce it again by an expensive medical exam, that's going to make it worse. So that's my only question. Can you please explain what we will do for these people, this group of people who, and I take the point by the Law Society, are probably not wealthy, many unemployed. Do they have to have an expensive medical exam? And if so, is there not a better way of getting the assessment done, Chairperson? Because poor people can't afford 3,000 rand for a medical assessment in order to claim 5,000 rand. That's just ridiculous.
Can I take a moment to confer? Yes,
please.
Thank you.
before you respond, I would also want to add on the question raised by Honorable Olive. And I'm going to make an example. The Road Accident Fund has got sites now in hospitals. And the idea is to have sites in all hospitals so that the Road Accident Fund can interact with the medical team that is treating the patients there. And in the accident that has recently happened in Mpumalanga, we came across a situation where the people that are representing the Road Accident Fund are people who also have a medical background that are in hospitals, who are able to work with the medical team in the hospital to immediately get an intervention that is required for each victim. Now, in view of that situation, my question is, this patient who is a victim of accident is in hospital, and in hospital there is team of doctors that are representing the hospital and the medical team that is representing the Road Accident Fund. The two teams talk and facilitate a situation where further assessments are done. Now the question is, does the Road Accident Fund cover for those assessments that are done? Because what we, the information that we came across was that of those victims, the assessment that had already been done was requiring a further intervention to remove the injured to other centers based on the assessment that was done in the hospital where the victim is, and also the information that is coming to the Road Accident Fund. And in some situation, it was the head injuries, and that required also transferring people to other centers, and in some situations, it was the limbs that required rehabilitation, and we were told that some of the people will have to undergo a rehabilitation program that takes longer for them to function again. The question that we are asking, which is what Mr. Ollis is asking, that assessment, is it covered by the Road Accident Fund, and how does it relate to the issue that is raised by the Law Society of South Africa? Thank you. Honorable Suka.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must also echo what has been raised by appreciating the presentation that was made by the Law Society. And if you did not read the bill very carefully, and its intention in terms of substantive matters, you will just agree without looking at the response of the department, because very eloquently so, they spoke very well in presenting their case. But also, on the other hand, the department itself, in responding to those concerns that were raised by the Law Society, they were also very able to put their case clearer to in responding and clarifying the positions from where they stand in terms of the substantive matters on the bill or the contents. Chairperson, maybe I want to make a comment rather than a question, because it needs also the committee to apply itself after this submission in terms of which to take to piece out those matters that are very helpful to the bill, so that nobody is unfairly discriminated in terms of the claims. I'm just thinking aloud, though it was raised last week, under this element of the unfair discrimination, where it is stated that tourists normally are compensated more than other people of the citizens of a particular country. Where do we say that? I need the department to echo that once again. They did try to explain, but I think it's a very serious matter if there is that real discrimination of a tourist vis-a-vis a local citizen of a country. I'm sure that's a question to be clarified. The second one, for me, Chairperson, you see, this bill is also trying to deal with the most vulnerable, disadvantaged communities. And as such, I would wish that this bill be in one of the indigenous languages, so that they also understand from the very onset the intention and the outcome of this bill, because it is known for very few people, but the majority who are the real victims don't understand that there is this move. So it leads us to, once again, public education through various platforms, either local, national media, radio stations, and so on, and in the various languages. I will plead with that very earnestly, irrespective. I know there might be financial impact when you do that, but the reality, these taxes that are running the national roads in the country are carrying mostly the disadvantaged communities, or there is tourists when they come from arrive at airports and so on. I think that is, for me, very critical, Chairperson. We did raise this matter. I'm raising it for matters of emphasis to show the seriousness that would want us this bill must get in terms of what we are trying to address. Chairperson, my last input would be that for me, it seems to me, because it's very engaging and it's demanding serious minds, and so that we broaden space, it would need also maybe to, with due respect, I know we've done that, to invite other key role players who must also input on this. I'm just thinking people who are traveling on a daily basis on these taxis, going to work, coming back, the trade unions should be involved here, so that they understand the message is carried through their work, shop stewards and so on, so that at least people are comfortable, so that tomorrow we are not challenged by the court of laws in terms of the communication and the consultation. So I want the committee to think towards a particular direction for more consultation and to be more involved, because it's going to touch millions of people who are not sitting here today. That's my concern, Chairperson. Otherwise, in terms of the contents of the bill, the substantive and the manner in which the department also has explained, I think it's real food for thought, and they did put their case very clear. Thank you.
We just need to make a correction to what Honourable Suga said. Most of what he said I agree with, but just one correction. It's not going to touch millions of people. It's only the people before 2008 who have already submitted claims. It's a small group. well, not small, I don't know how many it is, you can tell me how many the number is, but it's a specific group. It's not going to affect anybody who hasn't been in an accident before 2008 already. It doesn't affect new people who are in an accident now. It only affects those, maybe it's 1,000 people, I don't know how many it is, but it's a specific number of people, and really, honestly, only those specific people should be asked for comment, because they're the ones who are going to get financially disadvantaged. The rest of the public is not going to affect them, because the rest of the public falls under the new bill, who are already covered by the new bill. It's only those, perhaps the department can tell us how many, but they've got a specific number of claims that have already come in. It's finished. It's only those people. It's not the general public.
Madam Chair, if a number is required, Madam, according to the numbers that the RAF has been able to ascertain, it's between 10 and 15,000 claimants who already have claims in the system, and possibly minors and people who suffer from disabilities that would still have claims coming in that are not currently in the system. But the rough number is between 10 and 15,000.
Madam Chair, I don't want to speak out of turn, and I'll respond to the rest in due course. Can I just re-emphasize, all of those 10 to 15,000, or 98% of them, would already be represented by attorneys, and the attorneys would be members of the Law Society who have spoken here. So in a sense, they all have had their say, because their attorneys who speak on their behalf are members of the Law Society, which is presented here. So I certainly, from a legal point of view, there could be no doubt, sir, that the consultation that this committee has undertaken satisfies the requirements of the Constitution in respect to public consultation, because that appears to be your concern.
Thank you, Chairperson. I didn't want to be... I accept what you're saying, but I was talking about the outcome of the bill. It will touch the entire populace of this country. They must be educated. I was not referring to pre-2008. Thank you.
I would want to bring the two schools of thought together to say that there are people who were affected. We are dealing with the people that were affected after 2008. Okay. And amongst those people, there are those who would have known what to do. And there are those who have not known what to do. I have a practical example. The husband to my niece was involved in an accident in 2009. He has not claimed. He was injured. He's no longer working. He had two fractures on the upper leg, and he has an inset of a screw. He hasn't claimed. He's not part of those people that you are dealing with. He qualifies because it happened after 2008. That is what Honorable Suga is talking about, because there are people who are ignorant about their rights. And where do you find those people? You find them in the employ of farm workers. Even Vuvu is a farm worker, but an enlightened farm worker. Even the fact that those people are subjected to transportation by tractors, a type of a vehicle that is not designed to transport people, is a clear indication of the level of ignorance, but also of the level of poverty that then results with them subjected to those conditions. And what we are saying here is that there is nothing wrong in making those structures know about this situation. And a labor movement is one structure under which employees relate to. There are shop stewards that can talk to those people and make them aware. So it is not entirely correct that all those people that were affected are represented by the law society. So what they are arguing is then what is put forward here by the law society. If that was the case, we would not have a different argument coming from SACO. And SACO is the South African Commuters Organization. What we are saying is that allow a process that will satisfy a number of people and structures that may come back and make a lot of noise and say, we didn't claim because we were not aware. That is what Honorable Suga is saying. Honorable Suga.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to echo to Mr. Suga, because I have my neighbor who had an accident in 2009 when his mother lodged, then he died after 2 days. He had an accident in Craydock, and then they took him to Livingston Hospital in Port Elizabeth. And then he died after 2 days. When his mother lodged a claim, they said he didn't die the same day. So, you know, his mother was not working. It's the son only who was working in at that time. So she didn't claim. So things like that. I mean, because Mr. Suga said, Honorable Suga said, we must allow yourself to educate more especially those previously disadvantaged communities. For an example, this lady, I don't know whether is still qualifying or not, because he never claimed. They said he did, Mpakamisi didn't die the same day. I really don't know. It's confusing sometimes.
Okay. Orenda Kuroko.
Thanks, Chairperson. It is refreshing, I guess, because there's also a change, that we hear close legal arguments and battle of wits and minds. It is a new experience for many of us. We don't have it very often. But I sometimes think that in the technical analysis on the finer points of law, we miss the big picture. And what I'm struggling to understand as a new member, probably the newest member of this committee, is precisely what it is that the department and the Law Society can't agree on. So as I understand the Law Society's position, they would like the cap on the general damages to be done away with. And they made an argument about the 92% of people that to be unaffected anyway. They argue that it is possibly discriminatory the way it is, and essentially want to open up the claims for the general damages and not have them kept. As I understand the department, through their, I still don't know whether it's an advocate or an attorney, advocate Budlander, thank you. The department seems to be arguing that if you look at the proposed amendment bill, then it is a whole lot more generous than the old bill, sorry, old act and the new act, and they make a further statement that for serious injuries, there's an uncapped claim for general damages. And when I read through the substantive submissions, and having listened carefully to the arguments, it does seem to be that this is one thing. It's for the non-serious injuries and whether there's a cap on that or not. Now, I did understand what the Law Society argued. Well, I understand the arguments. I'm not in a position to really assess it from the... Well, some more clams coming in right now, I think. I'm not really in a position to argue from a historical point of view, so I just don't have the experience in that field as to what really the impact will be. And I think all of us are a little bit in the dark about knowing what the financial impacts on the fund will be. But what I would like perhaps more from the department is the actual reasoning why there shouldn't be a cap. Why there should be a cap on the 25,000. Is it because of what was alluded to by the advocate in the sense that we have got a 42 billion rand deficit on the fund, regardless of any one financial year where it may be in surplus, perhaps only because less claims reach settlement in that particular year than is expected according to actuarial analysis? Or is there another reason why they are saying that cap on the non-serious injury for general damages should remain? I'd just like to understand what the principal points of difference is between the two points of view. And I enjoy the legal argument, but I want to get to the nitty-gritty of what we actually asked to decide here.
Thank you. I will now allow the department, senior counsel, and if there are any other members from the team who would also want to add their voice, they are free to do so.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm just calling up a document which may assist me to answer one of the questions. And I'll, thank you. Madam Chair, thank you very, very much for the comments. Could I deal with them in the order that they came in? The first one, and the first two, in fact, related to the question of assessments. Can I say at the outset, Madam Chair, that we need to be clear on what we're saying, what we're describing as an assessment, and I think that's what your question was asking. The issue that was raised by the Law Society was not a medical assessment in the sense of trying to determine what medical treatment is needed. It was an assessment in a legal sense, in other words, an assessment of whether a given plaintiff has suffered a serious injury. So the way the new Act works, as you know, is that in order to claim general damages, you have to have suffered a serious injury. And there is a process which is a formal medical assessment which determines whether you have suffered a serious injury. In respect of those assessments only, I'm not talking about the ones that you raised, I'll come back to those in a moment. In respect of those assessments only, the position is as follows, and that goes to the Honourable Member's question that began. The position is, the RAF will pay for those assessments after they've been successful. In other words, if you are assessed as serious, your injury is assessed as serious, and if your claim is successful, the RAF does recompense you for the cost of the assessment. That's the first point. The second point is, even before your assessment occurs, if you can show to the RAF that you can't afford the assessment and that there's a reasonable possibility that the assessment will result in a finding of seriousness, then the regulations expressly provide for the RAF to do that. So, and that's, if I can give you the reference, it's Regulation 3.2b Roman 2, says expressly that if you cannot afford an assessment, you can approach the RAF, and if you can show that you can't afford it and that there's a likelihood that the injury may be assessed as serious, then the RAF pays for your assessment in advance. Now, the Law Society seemed to suggest that that system wasn't in place or it wasn't operational. I don't understand that with respect. I have personally been involved in advising the RAF on requests for the RAF to pay the assessment fee. So I know for a fact that the system is in place because I've seen the cases where it's been granted and there's been policies adopted and so on. So I think that would hopefully address your concern. If there is someone who can't afford to pay for an assessment, they or their attorney can approach the RAF and the RAF will pay for the assessment. In respect of other people who can afford to pay for the assessment, if they are found to be serious, the injuries are found to be serious, then the RAF will pay them back in terms of the regulations. In relation to your question, Madam Chair, which is the medical assessment in terms of future medical needs, that doesn't fall under the regulations. That simply falls under the, as I understand it, under the general medical provisions. And the position under the new Act, that's the existing RAF Act, and under this bill, is that the RAF will pay for all reasonable costs, including medical assessments of that sort. Then, in relation to the question of tourists, the question was raised in relation to the question of tourists. The example of tourists is a very, very serious one. And that is one of the reasons, but not the only one, for the cap on general damages. It goes back to the point that was raised. Let's say that amongst the 10 or 15,000 people who are out there is a tourist. That tourist's claim, if that tourist's claim might be very substantial. Very, very substantial, both in respect of loss of income and in respect of general damages. And that is the reason that both the new Act and this bill say we're going to cap everyone's loss of income at 160,000 plus inflation. It's now, I think, 187,000. And we're going to say that the only people who can claim general damages are seriously injured, because it's to avoid partly the abuse and the vast expenditure that resulted from tourists. That's not the only reason for the provision. I'll come back to it in a minute, but that is one of the reasons. And so this bill, in a sense, assists. I don't know whether there are tourists in the 15,000 claimants who can subject to it, but if there are, they will be subject to these limits, and it will avoid vast expenditure on them. Then, just to clarify, Madam Chair, the question was raised by you, Madam Chair, and by the Honourable Member, about persons who had not yet lodged a claim, who had had an accident in 2009. If they had an accident in 2009, they are not subject to this bill, because this bill, of course, only deals with people who had accidents prior to 1 August 2008. If they had an accident in 2009, it might not be too late for them to claim. They've got 3 years to claim, and so depending on when it happened, they may still be able to. But, of course, I mean, as you know, Madam Chair, the RAP has embarked on substantial public education systems, and so has the Department of Transport, but there certainly is an acute need for it to continue, and the examples demonstrate that. But the point is, neither of those examples suggest a need for further engagement on this bill, because this bill only affects people prior to 1 August 2008. That's the only point I was trying to make. I'm sorry I didn't make it clearly. And then the final point, and that's the one most recently raised by the Honourable Member, concerns the reason, and the Honourable Member is, of course, absolutely right. The only principal distinction between the Law Society on the one hand and the Department on the other is general damages. Everyone agrees, it seems, that there should be unlimited medical expenses. Everyone agrees, it seems, that there should be a cap on loss of earnings in accordance with the new Act, and there's been no argument on that. The only debate is about the cap on general damages. And can I, in order to deal with that, could I just remind you of where the skepticism, and I use that word deliberately, where the skepticism of general damages comes from originally. General damages were always part of our law. In fact, they're still part of our law. But general damages became a big focus of the road accident scheme, and large, vast sums of money were spent on general damages. When the Satchwell Commission reported, the Satchwell Commission and the Human Sciences Research Council were at pains to say that really general damages were being paid, and this is their words, that general damages in 2001, now these are old figures of course, but the system continued until the new Act came into force. General damages accounted for approximately 43% of the total compensation paid by the RAF to victims of road accidents in 2001. And they tended to be paid to people who had suffered light or moderate injuries and no damages, and who claimed no damages for medical costs or loss of income. So the Satchwell Commission and the HSRC found that 53% of the people who received general damages were only slightly injured, 29% were moderately injured, and only 17% were seriously injured. And that the Satchwell Commission then, following examples from all over the world, recommended that general damages should be limited only to those people who suffer serious injuries. With the idea being, if you suffer a loss of income, everyone can claim for that. If you have medical expenses, everyone should claim for that. But if you're going to be paid general damages, it should only be for those who are most seriously injured. And the Cabinet adopted that approach, put it before Parliament. Parliament adopted it, and I understand Cabinet adopted a similar approach in the context of the RABs. And so the principled answer to that is this, that general damages should only be given to those who are most seriously injured. But everyone can claim for loss of earnings, the actual loss, and the actual medical expenses. And the idea is that general damages give rise to vast sums of money being expended in circumstances where they are not really dealing with the people who are most desperately in need. And that's really the underlying principle. And that's the principle that this Parliament adopted in respect of the new Act, that the High Court upheld in the Law Society challenge. And this bill does no more than follow that decision that's already been made. And in fact, as I've indicated, this bill already allows a more generous approach to general damages than even the new Act. Because under the new Act, There's no claim for general damages if you're not seriously injured. But under this bill, even if you're not seriously injured, you can claim up to $25,000. And so the principled reason for that approach is twofold. Number one, that there is a skepticism of the extent to which general damages for non-seriously injured people are appropriate, because the state's money should be spent on those who are most seriously in need and who have life-threatening injuries, not minor injuries. And secondly, of course, allied to that is the financial constraints of the fund, that in determining where the cap should be placed, the cap should be placed there. But again, even having said all that, this bill is more generous even than the new Act in respect of general damages. Madam Chair, I hope that's answered all the questions. If not, I hope someone will draw my attention to it.
Madam Chair,
sorry. I still have to understand the what is the disagreement? Where the disagreement is between the Law Society and the department.
Yes.
I still have to understand that, because
can I?
In my mind it is not clear as to where is it that the provision of this bill.
Can I deal with that perhaps, Madam Chair, before my learned friend begins?
Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could draw your attention to the relevant provision. The only disagreement between, substantive disagreement between the Law Society and the Department is the proposed clause 2.1b. And I suppose it's 2.1a read with 2.1b. But if you read 2.1b, 2.1b says, the right of the third party to claim compensation for non-pecuniary loss is limited, non-pecuniary loss is general damages, of course, is limited to an amount of 25,000 rand unless, and then over the and then it says, the third party submits a serious injury assessment report and it's determined that the third party suffered a serious injury. Can I just finish explaining? So the position is that the department's view is that if you are not seriously injured, you can only claim up to 25,000 in general damages. The Law Society's view is that if you are not seriously injured, you should have an unlimited claim for general damages. That is the sole, as I understand it, substantive disagreement between the parties.
Can I paraphrase what I'm hearing? Can you switch off that?
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. What I am hearing you saying that the department is saying we will pay 25,000 for general damage, nothing more. We can only pay more if it can be proved that the injury is serious. The Law Society, on the other hand, is saying don't put a capping of 25,000 for general damaging. And also do not assess whether the injury is serious or not. Just pay. Even if I'm scratched here, I must claim what I think I deserve, without having a cap on that. That's what I'm hearing. Am I hearing it correctly?
Chairperson, with respect, you are, but I think for the portfolio committee's consideration when deciding this, general damages are proportionate as far as the courts can make to the extent of your injuries. So naturally, your scratch you refer to is a very limited amount of general damages. Let's call it 1,000 rand or whatever. And as your injuries get worse, so your general damages increases in value. Now, the proposal on the 30%, which is the serious injuries, that your people who have serious injuries are covered. But on our proposal, those people will still be covered in the same amount. There won't be any difference in amount. There's no increase in the amount of damages awarded. It's just the people who are getting damages, that number is increasing. So those people who are between the 25,000 rand for a limited claim, which everyone would have if it's slightly serious, but not a true serious one, they're getting paid what their true claim is worth. So you have a situation where, let's take for example my example I've used about the person who loses the lower limb below knee amputation, and if we go on the assessment, it's less than 30%. It's not a serious claim. On the current bill, his general damages will be worth, he will only get 25,000. I would submit that if you do it on what we say you should do it, he would get 200,000, or 50, or 250,000. So he would then be compensated for what he's getting. And we're saying, take away that gap. And if we go back to the 25,000 rand, we don't know where that comes from. It probably comes from the old Act, which I think was promulgated in the early 90s, originally from the Motor Vehicle Insurance Act in the 80s. That's been 25,000 rand for many years. We say do away with that. Give everyone, and we say particularly this class of people, the poor and the black, which the court determined, that's the court found, give them a claim. For what it's worth, give them a claim. While I'm dealing with general damage, a tourist's general damages are no higher than yours or mine. Because general damages are related to the injuries you suffer. It's not related to your income. The tourist's claim for income is usually huge because it's in foreign currency. But not their claim for general damages. Their claim for general damages is the same as yours or mine. Two broken arms is the same whether you're German or whether you're South African. So we're saying, let the people who have suffered get a general damages claim, unlimited, in other words, what it's worth. Don't limit it to 25,000 rand. Give those people whose claims were 75,000 rand, give them 75,000 rand. Mr. Budden's argument. He says, look at this act, what we're giving you is so much more than you can get today, but he's losing sight of the argument. Is the current act, the new act, doesn't discriminate against anyone. We're all equal in terms of that act. We've all got a limited claim for generals, a cap claim for loss of earning. This act, the old act, discriminates between passengers. And the constitutional court says you cannot discriminate. Now, Mr. Button has said, but they're better off than the new act. Of course they should be better off. They should be, all things being equal, and if the finances were there, they should be getting exactly the same as the other people in terms of the old act. But are we stopping that? We're not getting it. So we're saying as a law society, yes, we have to look at constraints. But let's look at constraints where the people can most afford it. Those are the people who are earning more than 160,000 rand a year. It's now 194. They can afford to limit their claim. Because they're still getting compensation. The people who are out of a job and are badly injured but not seriously injured, they need that money to get on the flight. They need it. The argument by that, well, now all your medical costs are incurred. By the nature of this inquiry we have in the Mavuma case, everyone's poor. They don't have medical costs, they use state hospitals, they don't pay them. So what does it mean to a poor person that you're going to pay medical expenses which he doesn't pay for anything? Where's the advantage to that person? We as a law are saying, look after the poor. Give them what's due. And I'm surprised to hear that it's only 10,000 to 15,000 claims. How much is that in reality on a general damages claim? But everyone's going to get 25. Your senior are going to get on the argument now. All we're saying is fill the gap. How many people are going to fall in that gap? Not that many. Because we've got the serious claim above 30%, and we've got those below 25. We're saying, open it to the people. let them be compensated for the damage.
Chairperson, I've listened carefully to all these arguments, and Mr. Butler at this point explained this problem that has been raised now, and there's been no counter to his point. His point was that if you have an injury which is, say, for example, only 30%, there is a second way that the assessment can be made, and you are not immediately excluded. There is a second bite at the cherry, and that has not been countered by the Law Society. So I'm persuaded, personally, I'm not speaking on behalf of every DA member, my colleague may disagree with me, he's free to have his own view, but I am convinced by Mr. Badlander's argument that these people, before 2008 only, these are the only people we're talking about, that 15 or 16,000 depends on how many claim, those people will be in a much better position than they were if we approve this thing. We can say almost a rand value how much better off. They're going to be 1.3 billion rand better off. So to pretend that they're not going to be better off is disingenuous. It's going to cost us 1.3 billion. So they're getting extra money. And which way they get the money is obviously a debate, and the Law Society has brought some very good points about how we divide that cake up. But I'm persuaded by Mr. Badlander's argument. It was very detailed. He specifically gave us each counterpoint as to how they can claim, and if this committee is convinced that his answer in terms of the medical assessment is acceptable, then actually, personally, I'm happy to let the matter rest. I think the department's advocate has done a really good job of explaining the position, and I'm convinced by that argument. I do think we should have asked these questions because there's some very important questions here, but I'm convinced by that argument. I think that he's made the point clear that if you're excluded because your claim is less than 30% or whatever else it is, then you can, I forget the term.
The narrative test. And it's under regulation 3.1b Roman 3.
So that
there are four possibilities.
So that person missing a leg or missing an arm has got a second way of claiming, and I feel that that is fair. If that is true, then I'm happy to let the matter rest. I think that he has explained it very carefully, and I'm happy with this amendment because we can't give everybody a blank check. We can't say yes, 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. I mean, somewhere along the line we have to actually say this is as much as the country can afford, and I'm convinced by that argument.
Thank you, Honourable Oyen. Honourable Kronbrock.
Thanks, Chairperson. You know, sometimes it's helpful to look at these matters as if you are the person in the position of claiming. And sometimes our views might be quite different when you're on the other side of the fence. What I would need in my mind to be totally secure that I haven't marginalized even one person who doesn't deserve to be marginalized, I think that's the point, is the question I want to ask is, how many people are there in the category that the Law Society describes? In other words, people who have a genuine claim for an injury which is worth, in objective market terms, and I know that's also a difficult concept, that is much more than 25,000, right, that can't qualify under the serious injury category. I'm sorry if I'm not putting it quite as clearly as a lawyer would, but I just want reassurance in my own mind that having listened carefully to the argument that 43% of the fund was taken up by these general claims and that only, I think it was 17% of them, was it? Was only serious injuries. I'm very persuaded as someone who also has to take a responsible view to the public fiscus that we can't be paying out literally billions of rands for claims that are essentially, in many ways, and I say this with respect, perhaps not as serious as what the original drafters of all this legislation envisaged. I'm putting it delicately, but I think we'd want people to be paid out who genuinely deserved compensation and not necessarily people getting paid out a lot of money because they've got a very good attorney. And I say that with respect to attorneys in general and in particular here. So what I'm really trying to say is, or ask, is are there people that actually in objective, rational, humanitarian terms deserve a lot more than 25,000 that won't be accommodated under this amendment, proposed amendment, by way of the narrative test that my colleague describes as a second bite of the cherry? I mean, is there someone that's got a genuine claim that's going to be left behind, as it were, if we had to approve what the department is asking us to approve? And I think I'd like both the department and the Law Society to answer that. So I don't think we can make 100 people better off if you're making one person worse off. I think we've got to try and make sure that every single person is who genuinely needs that assistance is catered for. I'd hate to have a few victims trailing in our wake, even if we're helping the majority and we're helping the fund and we're helping the fiscus.
Madam Chair, if I could just reply to that. I dealt with it in my opening address, where I quoted you from the Fabricius judgment, where it said that 92% of the claims are below 50,000 rand. Now, we mustn't, the learned honourable member, mustn't now think that this narrative test is now a wonderful test that gives everyone a claim for general damages. It's just another way of trying to show that it's a serious injury. It's still cutting out the people at the bottom. And the RAF itself, in the case, estimated that 92% of all claims are below 50,000 rand. So we're saying, if you take the current situation, the current amendment, you've got 25,000 rand, they're all going to be paid. You've got your serious claims, let's say above 300,000, they're going to be paid. But what we're saying, just give the gap in the middle, because they are part of your 92%. So my learned friend is cutting out, with his support of it, of a large, large percentage of the poor people. And there are the numbers, 92 is below 50,000.
Thanks, Chairperson. I thought I wouldn't speak today because I think the representative from the department has explained everything clearly. I think we understand that. So I don't agree yet. We are representing people, especially the poor. We are not representing any law firm or any organization. But what we need to understand is that, like my colleague has already said, I was also involved in an accident during the time when we were busy preparing the funeral and memorial service of the people of Mpumalanga. So I wasn't injured, but I was traumatized. Does that mean I must claim for something, for money that I don't deserve? No, we can't have that. Assessment must be done, and it must be paid according to the injuries that a person has insured. So I agree with the department fully, though we are representing people on the ground, the poor people, but I do agree with the department on this one, that money must be paid based on the injuries that someone has suffered. You cannot give everyone a blank check. That will mean that it's like defrauding the government to claim for something that is not there. Thanks, Chair.
Madam Chair, perhaps just one last response in response to the Honourable Member and the Law Society. Can I explain the difficulty with respect both with the question posed and the answer given? It's all very well to speak about what an objective claim and what a claim is objectively worth. But what, for example, can I use this example, is whiplash worth? What we saw under the old Act is that people who had whiplash, not severe whiplash that led to days and days of bed, but people who had whiplash would claim for significant general damages on us. And the aim of the new Act and the regulations and the test is to try and weed out those claims, because whiplash might be painful, but it's not the sort of injury that has an effect on your life going forward. And so what the threshold is trying to do is, and the threshold that was endorsed by Parliament in the new Act, so it's not a novel question. What the threshold is trying to do is separate out injuries which have a serious effect on your life going forward from those which do not. And just say everyone can claim for medicals and everyone can claim for loss of income, but if you want general damages, those are what the Sackville Commission called life enhancement benefits, because we only give them to you if your life has been changed going forward. And if I could just say to you that the narrative test, my learned friend says, well, the narrative test is just another test. But can I just read to you the wording? If you can show that you suffered, if you're assessed as suffering a serious long-term impairment or loss of a body function, then you get generals. If you can show that that the injury constitutes a permanent serious disfigurement, then you get generals. The whole emphasis is on permanence and long-term effects. If you had a permanent injury, a long-term effect on the injury, you get generals. If you didn't, if it's a temporary injury, it might have been painful, it might have been traumatic, you don't get generals. You can claim for the rest, but not generals. And so that's the scheme that the new Act puts in place. And this bill, far from making that scheme more restrictive, as I keep indicating, is more beneficial. Because it says even the whiplash victim, even the person with the scratch, is entitled to claim up to $25,000. And that's the real point. It's more beneficial than that. But it says we're only giving unlimited general damages to people who suffer long-term injury. And that's, I hope that answers your question. And that's why what it ensures is that no one who suffers a serious injury, a long-term injury, will be left out in the cold, because they'll be able to claim general damages. Thank you, Madam.
All right. Is there anyone between the two parties, the department and the law society, who still wants to put an argument on this? In our view, we have heard you, and we will make our decision on the basis of what you have put in front of us. We have clearly heard you. The fact that there are no hands that are being raised from this side indicates that these honorable members have heard both arguments and they have no further issues to raise to get a better understanding of the argument. The opportunity that I'm giving now is for the two parties to argue, because there's only one bone of contention. It is the capping of 25,000 and then the assessment of a serious injury. Those are the only two bones of contention. Is there anyone who feels that no, we have not been heard clearly? If then there is no one who feels that they have not been heard clearly, I would take this opportunity to thank the Law Society of South Africa for first having an interest on this matter as the people that have been providing services, mainly to those who could not claim for themselves, the poor. We appreciate that you have had an interest in this. The second issue is that we want to thank you for coming forward to make your presentation and your argument. It demonstrated that you are part of this country and you are interested in how Parliament arrives at a decision. You don't sit back and complain after a decision has been taken. You actually influence the decision, and we thank you for that. And if you have no further input, we would gladly
Chairperson, can I just ask you a technical question for the committee? It doesn't involve the presenters. we obviously have to, as a committee, produce a report and agree on our position. Are we going to do that on another day, or are we going to do that now after this meeting? I'm not sure what the process is.
In terms of the procedure, we have to sit as the committee and go through the bill clause by clause. We can't decide on our own on whether we want to do that today or we want to do it on another day. Honorable Onyes, followed by Honorable Saguda. Sir, I think we need to have another day to do this because we are having a memorial service 12:30 for that colleague of ours. There is then a proposal. Honorable Zabute is proposing that we do that on another day because there is a memorial service for Honorable Matthew.